Good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, here with another segment on the show about disaster, disaster response, and everything to do with disasters. And I'm back here with my co-host, Sam Bradley, as well. Sam, welcome back, as always. We always look forward to getting together on our regular recording nights, and we're back with another good topic tonight.
I enjoy it too, Jamie. We're out here just, you know, every day hoping there isn't a disaster somewhere. But if there is, then Joe and I are ready for it. And Dr. Joe's with us here too. So hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. Good to be back.
So, you know, we were talking about a couple of things. First of all, you know, we record this show a couple of weeks in advance, and you've probably figured that out based on some of the news items we covered. But a lot of things going on in the news with regards to disasters and major casualty events and major responses. I've had three aircraft downed. We've got a semi-active war zone going on in part of the Middle East, and there's been a lot going on in the news that makes us think about what we would do in a major casualty event, whether it's man-made or otherwise.
That's very true. Yeah, I was just reading an article on the cluster of airline disasters, which a lot of people say is just, you know, I read something where it said, well, it could happen every day or like not happen for another 10 years. You just kind of never know. And even though one of those was intentional, so to some extent you have to rule that out as, you know, something that you wouldn't expect. I mean, weather-related things, yeah. But it's just been weird, like within a week to have three of them go down. And I think one of them, I don't know that they found it yet. So we'll have to cross our fingers that that isn't going to continue, especially for all of the people, all of the families involved and with the folks on those aircraft.
Well, and it brings us around to thinking about, you know, these are unexpected disasters. And it brought us back around to a news article that I saw a few weeks back having to do with the United States Geological Service remapping the nation's earthquake hazard and basically put out a whole new map and included 42 states at risk, including 16 states at high risk, and some states that are probably a little surprised that they're in a high-risk zone, which I was very, very interested to see, including, Joe, parts of Tennessee.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, surprisingly enough, we're in a very high-threat area for earthquakes. The New Madrid Fault, which was the source of the most destructive earthquake in the country back in the early 1800s, is just north of Memphis and sort of runs along the Mississippi River all the way up into near the Great Lakes, actually. And obviously a lot of large communities like Memphis and St. Louis and others would be right in the path of that. Interestingly enough, one of the primary focuses for training and exercises from the FEMA USAR system is centered around an earthquake on the New Madrid Fault.
Well, I'd hate to think that would turn into a real earthquake someday, but stranger things have happened. So, Joe, what, you know, not being an expert in Tennessee, what kind of things would be disrupted? I mean, what kind of problems would present themselves? Say there was an 8.0, something that could really do some damage to buildings and infrastructure. What are some of the things you'd be most concerned with?
Well, I think, you know, there's several differences between the New Madrid Fault area in the center of the country and places that are sort of known for earthquakes like California. The soil here is quite different. The building codes are not quite as stringent, and the infrastructure, I think, is a lot more fragile and less protected from earthquakes because they're so rare in this part of the country. But, you know, I think the effects would be devastating, to say the least. If it was a significant quake, it literally would sever most of the transportation lines between East Coast and West Coast, crossing the Mississippi River. It would be devastating to certainly to my part of the country, because we have a huge infrastructure in place for transportation and distribution of products and goods. The Mississippi River is an incredibly busy river for barge traffic, both upriver and downriver. And, you know, the economic impact of losing the interstate bridges over the Mississippi River between east and west would be overwhelming. I can't even imagine how in the world commerce might continue. It would all have to be flown over or moved by barge until those bridges were rebuilt, and that's obviously not going to be a fast process. So I think the impacts would be absolutely horrendous.
So are they doing anything to prepare the infrastructure for a potential quake?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of stuff underway in my part of the world, including actively working right now on all of those major interstate overpasses over the Mississippi River to strengthen them and provide them with significantly higher seismic capability. There's been an awful lot of changes in our building codes here in my part of the world to bring us up to a much higher standard than we've had here in the past. The planning that's been going on behind the scenes has been absolutely amazing. The last large-scale exercise that we had here was called Tin Cat, which was a Tennessee, earthquake preparedness exercise where we utilized our statewide resources for ambulance strike teams and the whole bit to be able to move resources from the central and eastern part of the state over to the western part of the state. So that we could be moving patients out of this area and repatriating them to areas where medical services would be available.
Yeah, and you really do have to think on a large scale like that. You mentioned your soil. What about the infrastructure? Did you say there was a lot of unreinforced masonry in Tennessee still?
Yeah, there is. I mean, certainly many of the cities here are fairly old from their construction standpoint, and because it's been a very long time, 150 years since we've had a significant earthquake here, people's memories fade, and things don't get taken care of probably like they need to be. So many of the older structures in and along the Mississippi River, both in Tennessee and northbound, are fairly unreinforced masonry structures and will not do well at all in the event of a big earthquake, especially with the very soft and sandy type soils that we have here. Those buildings literally will sink into the ground to some extent and fall apart. So there's going to be a lot of damage here when something bad really hits.
So what about the hospital infrastructure? What you know about them? Just, I'm sure you don't know every hospital in the state. Well, maybe you do. But how do you think the hospital, the health, public health infrastructure would stand up?
Well, I think it's probably not too bad. Most of our major medical centers have undergone pretty significant seismic renovations in the last few years. And certainly all the newer hospitals have probably exceeded code when it comes to that sort of stuff. The VA Medical Center here underwent a massive renovation effort where they literally took a 7 or 8 story tall building and took the top 3 floors off of it and reinforced it all and put it on, rubber pads so it would move and all that sort of stuff, and literally made the building shorter so that it swayed less and would be more earthquake resilient.
Well, that makes perfect sense. But like you said, they're only now starting to realize the potential severity here, such that they're rebuilding these things or trussing them up, the bridges in particular. And that's not someplace I'd want to be, on a bridge over the Mississippi.
Absolutely not. Yeah, you know, I think we're likely to see pretty significant damage to the infrastructure, like you know, gas pipelines and water pipelines and electricity and stuff like that probably hasn't been hardened as much as it should be or could be, and so I think those things will probably be impacted pretty heavily.
Well, that kind of begs another question. I know on earthquakes that I've worked hurricanes in the South. And they have a very low water table, to the extent that they can't really even bury people underground. And for those that have a lot of sewers rather than piped water, they lose their water. How does that work in your area as far as the water supply?
Well, you're right. The water table is not terribly deep underground. And I think in the event of an earthquake, obviously that the ground is fairly loose anyway, and water table is fairly close to the surface, and that's just simply going to make that ground that much softer and that much more impactful to roads and bridges and infrastructure that's flowing through it, like underground cabling and pipe and sewage lines and that sort of stuff.
Wow. Okay, so let's speculate. It's tomorrow morning, and I'm not certainly hoping I'm not going to make this happen. But it's 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you wake up to an 8.0 earthquake. What would you do? Let's just center around the Memphis area in general. What would be kicked in immediately? How would your state respond and your city?
Wow, that's a great question. We're blessed to actually have the USAR team based right here in Memphis. Interestingly enough, my first thought goes sort of there, just because that's my passion. But I think the Tennessee USAR team would probably not even be active officially as a federal asset. We would all be busy in our own jurisdictions with our own departments, and to pull that away and put a team together and turn around and send it right back to work would seem rather ridiculous. So we'd obviously be utilizing all the equipment, supplies, and training that we have, but we probably wouldn't be doing it in a under the auspices of the federal system. We'd all be local at that point. The Emergency Operations Center for the city, which my friend and partner Jim Logan's in charge of, would be very active very quickly. We have a very robust emergency management agency at the state level with emergency assistance compacts to our sister states all around us to begin generating stuff. We have indeed exercised, as I told you earlier, getting assets moving very quickly in an effort to be ahead of that game, knowing that we're going to have to stage many of those assets in places that may be 50 miles away from, the city of Memphis in order to still have functional roads. And figuring out ways to move patients is going to be a real challenge. We've been working very hard on looking at air assets as a way to do that. We've got a very large Air National Guard presence here with the C-5 Galaxy aircraft, which is literally the most monstrous aircraft I've ever seen in my life.
Hell yeah.
We've had a lot of drills in moving patients with those things, moving equipment in and out, and getting those things moving as well. So there are an awful lot of different components that will get up and get moving very quickly, and we've tried to practice those aggressively. I think, as always, the real key there is going to be the communication piece, as always is the problem with every one of these big events, and how we're able to communicate our needs and then coordinate the response of those assets once they get rolling.
Yeah, I have so many questions rolling around in my head right now. But you're touching on a point I want to go back to about those of us that do the federal work are usually doing a lot of other things. And when our own area is affected by a disaster, we kind of have to take, you know, okay, which of these many roles do I fall into? And probably the least of which is going to be one, our federal role, because they're not going to pull from the folks that are actually in a, I know for DMAT, they won't pull for from people within the disaster area. Now, USARS are a little more rare, so I don't know if that would be the same for USARS if there were.
Are the other USAR teams in the United States? That would be a question I'd have.
Sure. Well, they're located. They're actually scattered all over the country. Although, you know, there's a large number of them along the West Coast in California, where obviously they grew out of, you know, wildland fire and earthquake response. There's a fair concentration in the Northeast around the Washington, D.C., New York area, where the population centers are. And then beyond that, they're scattered quite a bit around the country. There are several USAR teams located in the central U.S. from Nebraska to Ohio and Missouri. There are several teams in Florida. There are a couple of teams in Texas. Arizona has a team. Washington has a team. So overall, the system has about 28 teams in it that are on alert at all times and ready to go in the event of a call out by FEMA.
So it's not such a rare or scarce resource that there wouldn't be teams that could come in and help bail you guys out. It's not like you're the only ones in town. You definitely would have resources brought to bear to fill in where you might fill in for others.
Absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, that's exactly how the system is designed to work, is that the if the big one hits in California, then those guys on the California task forces are going to be busy in their own departments and their own fire departments, their own services. And the rest of the system is designed to go there and provide assistance. So I think when something big happens in the central U.S. from an earthquake standpoint, there's a very real chance that while both the Tennessee team and Ohio and Missouri and others will be right near ground zero, we may not be actively doing very much just because we're all going to be busy locally. So, the team will be functioning just sort of not at the federal level. We'll sort of be functioning at the local level, I think.
So given your multiple roles, and I know there are many, how would you prioritize putting USAR aside, and given that that's probably not the first thing you jump into, but when you walk out of your door that day, where are you going to go?
Well, that's a good question. a lot of that's going to depend on where can you go. We have a lot of bridges, a lot of bridges here, et cetera. I'm going to attempt to immediately reach out to probably my local emergency operations center and be functioning at a bit of a coordinating level for the pre-hospital services that I'm medical director for, and trying to coordinate those and work toward the most applicable utilization of the resources that we have that are functional. But I think that those first few hours are going to be really challenging, just figuring out what's functional, what's not, how far can it go. Those guys can't respond to that area anymore because there's no bridge there anymore, so we got to send somebody else over there. We've done all kinds of things to help mitigate that a little bit by generating or building mass casualty trailers and supply depots, and have strategically placed them around this area so that if many of the bridges go down and there are multiple sort of isolated areas that are between two rivers, that they have a way to respond with supplies that are already in place there. So that's been part of our strategy, is a realization that we're not going to be able to move vehicles or maybe even boats into some of those areas, and it's all going to have to be done by air, and that those assets are going to be very rare and very precious in those first few days.
Well, given the first few days, I think a lot of that would just be trying to get communication on, trying to get a sense of how bad is it? And I know typically in earthquakes, as it happens in here in California, the areas you hear from last are the ones that seem to be the most affected because they're not able to really get communications out right away. That's been pretty typical. So how do you gather information? Say Middle Tennessee is affected by this. How do you get that incoming information so you can get a sense of the damage, which will give you a sense of what your resources need to be?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of that's going to end up flowing through probably old school radio communications. I think the cellular system, certainly my experience with the cellular system in big disasters, is it goes down very quickly. Mm-hmm. It can come up fairly quickly with these portable cell on wheels, or cows as they're called, these big tractor trailer rigs that literally can drive in with a generator and a cellular tower and fire up in a parking lot and be able to supply some of those services. But you know, it's going to take some time to make that happen, and obviously everybody's going to be on their cell phone trying to find out what happened and check on their loved ones and all that sort of stuff. So it's going to have to be fairly old school with VHS radios and person-to-person communications, I think, in many cases.
Well, and people need to be reminded that our experience here in California is you can't get, for those that still have landlines, you won't be able to get through on those.
Exactly right.
And
exactly.
Part of that reason is they're just so overloaded. So one thing just to throw out there to folks, you are more likely to be able to get a hold of somebody out of state than you are in state. So it's always a good idea when you do your disaster family planning is to have the numbers, make sure your whole family has the numbers of somebody out of state that can then be the repository of information for anybody else that's going to call or find out about you when they can't connect with you directly. And the other thing I wanted to say on communication is God bless our ham radio operators, because almost inevitably the first communications that come out of a disaster area are those guys, because they're not bound by cell towers or anything else. And a lot of the exercises they do for disaster are done completely on battery. They don't even depend on electricity, and they're always prepared to jump out there, go to fire departments, go to the EOCs, go to the key government buildings to form that network of communications. So this is where we really these guys are really at their best.
Absolutely. We too will rely on those guys very heavily to provide us with a means of communication when most of the other systems that we rely on a day-to-day basis are not going to be available at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy and I talked with them when we went to the disaster preparedness show recently. And even though I'm a ham myself, I haven't used it for a while, but talking with those guys was fascinating. And they're wonderful. I mean, they're volunteers, and they do a lot of exercises with different agencies, and they're just ever present. But they seem to be kind of on the down low until you really need them, and then there they are.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's because communication is just such an important resource and a scarce resource during a deployment or disaster event. Until those lines of communication are restored in some way, or until face-to-face communication can be established by actually sending a body to a given area to get eyes on a specific problem and then report back with it, those lines of communications are precious. And any way we can get out. I remember some of the things going on here on the East Coast during the last set of hurricanes that came through. Text messaging was easier to get out than a phone call in some situations, because it's a tiny burst of data and it doesn't tie up a phone line very long. So all these things are just important little tricks to keep in mind, and makes me appreciate, I think, some of the things we take for granted, that we're just going to be able to pick up our phone and update our Facebook status and let everybody know we're okay. Well, that may not be possible for days. and we come back to that necessity of the local areas being responsible for being somewhat self-sufficient for the first 48 to 72 hours before federal resources can deploy.
You make a really good point, Jamie, because I haven't thought about, you know, so much the texting capability that might actually still be there. Who knows? Maybe people will be able to get out to social media before they can pick up a phone and call someone. So that's kind of that's something we should probably study a little bit. That's really kind of intriguing. What do you think, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. I think it takes a very long time to get things rolling, and you certainly better be prepared to depend on yourself primarily, or you're going to be pretty disappointed, I think, for quite a while.
Well, and I think I have to say that, unfortunately, you kind of touched on it earlier, Joe, we tend to be complacent when something hasn't happened for a while. And even though we know the potential is there, it's like, well, I can do that tomorrow, and I'll go and check my disaster preparedness stuff next week. And so how prepared are you really? And I think that complacency can really create a problem if people really, they have to think this could happen tomorrow, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's just one of those things. Everybody tends to put it off because it's low probability and not likely to happen, and then when it does, it's catastrophic and overwhelming, and that's just the nature of those entities, and that's why it tends to catch people out of sorts.
So well, you're saying a little bit of paranoia is a good thing?
I think for something like that, I think you have to look at it from the standpoint of, yes, that's an extremely unlikely occurrence, but wow, the impact of something like that happens is going to be overwhelmingly devastating. So it's low probability, but it's very high risk. And, I think that at least warrants a little some sort of response to help make sure that you've got at least a minimum level of preparedness.
Well, we'll make sure we have a link to this news release from the USGS and their updated map for 2014, because I think for some people out there, it might be quite eye-opening. I know it was for me just looking at this big red splotch that's right in the middle of the country, right over Memphis. We thought of you, Joe, instantly when we looked at it, because when you compare the size of that red dot, it equals the whole West Coast, the amount of red on the entire West Coast. And here it is, this right in the center of the U.S., where you don't think about seismic activity. And yet, here we are, everybody says, oh, California is going to have the earthquake, the big one, right? Well, this map really woke me up to maybe not necessarily. And it's good to hear that you all have been preparing for this when the rest of us were unaware that it was something that needed to be concerned about.
Well, I think you're exactly right. That was somewhat the same effect from the earthquake about, 3 years ago or so that hit Washington, D.C. and did significant damage to the Washington Monument and others. That was quite a wake-up call for an area that definitely doesn't expect to get earthquakes much at all. So that just lets you know.
Well, I remember it. I sat there and went, what the heck is that? And then I said, oh, my gosh, that's an earthquake. And it didn't last very long. It was 5 or 6 seconds from my standpoint. But it was a long time when you think about it. I mean, everything moved.
Absolutely.
Move slowly when you're in the middle of it. Were you there at the time, Jamie?
We felt it here at our house. So, rattled the china closet and that kind of stuff. And it was kind of this. I can't even describe it because I've never actually been in an earthquake before, but it just felt kind of like everything kind of rumbled and moved, and then it was over. And by the time it was done, it took me that long to realize what it was.
Absolutely.
Well, it's funny because if that you know, type of thing happened in California, we'd sit there for a few seconds going, yeah, okay, whatever, next. For you guys, it really does rattle you because you don't know. You know, a lot of people are in fear that that's a foreshock and something worse is going to happen. And, you know, but we tend to be a little more complacent out here. Unless it's about a 6.5 or a 7, we don't even think too much about it.
Well, and as Joe pointed out, our building codes are not built to be seismically reactive, so we don't have, which is why we had all the county schools shut down, because so many of the schools developed cracks in their masonry after this quake, and suddenly we found all these structural problems or potential structural problems. It turned out that none of them was dangerous to the underlying structure itself, just more cosmetic. But nobody knew that until they got an engineer in there to look at it, because nobody built buildings to withstand any kind of seismic activity.
Yeah, you're reminding me of my Red Cross days, because one of the things that we would do as disaster workers, what we call a windshield survey, and I'm sure Joe's familiar with it, but we'd basically drive around and say, what can we see from the vehicle that gives us a sense of the damage such that we can report back and say, oh, you know, well, this is really bad or it's not so bad. But one of those things is when a home is actually destroyed functionally, you can't see it all that well. But it could be that the foundation actually shifts on the on its own foundation, and that can't be repaired where it looks like it's structurally sound. Sometimes you have those issues, so it takes a while for folks to figure out how much damage there really is and to what extent the damage has happened.
Well, we could sit here and talk about this all night, but believe it or not, we've been talking for a half an hour about it.
Oh, no. Yeah, it is good.
It is good. But, I mean, it just goes to point out, and Joe, you know, you've helped people train and prepare for these things in your local system, through your USAR team, and especially through what you guys do at Paragon Medical Education Group, where you bring all of this experiential training so that people can be prepared for the unexpected event, the once in a lifetime response that a responder needs to be ready for, but is inherently unprepared for by their basic training.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie, and that's exactly why we do that, is certainly an understanding that they are very rare events, and as with many of these high-stress events, you're going to fall back into what you've been trained to do, and the better prepared you are from that standpoint, the more likely you are to mitigate the amount of damage or injury, and the best you'll be able to do to take care of yourself and your family and provide help to others.
If folks want to find out more about what you guys have to offer and maybe bring some of that kind of training, preparedness training, to their own system, I know we had one of our audience members contact us via Facebook recently, and I put them in touch with you, just wanting to reach out and find out more about something like an active shooter response. Where can they find you guys?
Well, we're at ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web, as well as on Facebook with the same name. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
And I highly recommend everybody, if you have a system and you have an opportunity to bring Joe and the team in to do specific kind of training. They offer training in all sorts of response and preparedness for disasters, from like we said, active shooter drills to cadaver labs with specific events focused. So to take advantage of the resources that they have, and you won't be sorry. It's going to really change the way you all think about how prepared you are, and that's a good thing. Well, Sam, we're done. Another episode here. I can't believe it. You know, we've been doing this for about 6 months now, and it just has been, it's flown by.
It has, and it's so much fun. I mean, we'll get so heavily into a topic, we don't even realize how much time has passed. But I'm really hoping that the folks that are listening, we're starting to get a lot more response out there in social media, and our friend Tim that suggested something for us on the website. And we'd love to hear more from people. I would like to hear more from people in different states and give us some idea what their disaster preparedness scenario looks like and what they have concerns about. Because to me, it's just kind of fascinating. I don't know as much as I'd like to know about other areas of the country and what they're dealing with.
Maybe I can get our good friend Richard Brooks on to talk about disaster preparedness in this area.
Right, yeah.
He might be a good guy to get on here one night. I'll have to see if I can bring him on the show one evening. That's my local Department of Emergency Services director here that's state appointed, and he runs things for this county. And Sam got the chance to meet him at the last EMS Today event. So we'll have to see about getting him on. But anyway, Sam, where can folks find you if they want to reach out and suggest a topic or get in touch with you?
Oh, I'd certainly love that. Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, and the usual multiple social media places, and certainly at the disasterpodcast.com website.
And you can find me under the handle PodMedic just about everywhere. So look me up on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or wherever the case may be. And, of course, always over at DisasterPodcast.com. Make sure you follow up over there. You can leave a comment on any of the episodes over there, and it actually emails us so we can actually get back in touch with you and get your questions answered or respond to your comments and suggestions. And we want to hear more from you. We've started hearing a lot from different people. And that's a good thing because this is a community effort here at the Disaster Podcast that we want to hear back from you about topics you want to hear more about. What can we revisit that we've covered in the past? And what new topics are out there that you haven't heard yet on the show or you'd like to see us cover? So in any case, we look forward to hearing from you over at DisasterPodcast.com. That's it for me and Joe and Sam. Sam, why don't you just wrap us up as we always do?
Well, and I think everything we talked about proves the point that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.